Hey guys, Eric with Tourism Marketing Mastery. I've got a really cool episode here for you today. We did an interview with Doug Lansky, who is the number one sought after speaker in tourism. And he dropped a bunch of gold nuggets in this podcast episode. He's going to be talking about where a lot of opportunities lie for all the stakeholders in tourism, but that includes us as resort owners, tour operators. And he's also going to be looking at what the future of tourism looks like. There's also a few personal anecdotes thrown into this. And then also, treat for you at the end, just what Doug would do with a budget if he had to bring an ROI and bring visitors into a resort, a step-by-step of what that would look like. So stay tuned for that. We're about to jump into it. Hey, my name is Eric Hatterscheidt, and I'm part of a group of independent tourism operators that you've probably never heard of. We deliver experiences that are beyond a photo shoot. When they're not, we actually have to change our guests' lives. But because we don't have unlimited budgets like the big brands, we have to think differently. We have to be clever with our marketing. We need to reach our audiences to make the impact, but we also need to be profitable right from the start. Unfortunately, traditional education is about 20 years behind, and they aren't teaching us what we need to know. So we've decided to take matters into our own hands. We're sharing marketing tactics that work today, because we are experienced masters, and what we do matters. Hey there, this is Eric Hatterscheidt with Tourism Marketing Mastery. And today I'm pretty excited because we've got an incredible guest on the show. His name is Doug Lansky, and he is a world-renowned keynote speaker within the tourism industry. And I really wanted to bring him on because he, I think, brings a really grounded perspective to what's going on in tourism as a whole. But I also thought that he could bring some insight into how we operate as individual operators and what we can do with our own tourism experiences to maybe not even so much just enhance that experience as look at a different way of bringing experience to the industry. I also wanted to bring him on because what I foresee part of this interview being is a jump from the micro to the macro and back and forth, and just looking at how that all intertwines and maybe some potential ideas, maybe not solutions, but ideas for where things could go to make it a win-win for the industry as a whole. Now, I think it's important that I actually give Doug some credit for his history, because he has a very, very impressive history. He's been living abroad and traveling for nearly 20 years. He's been in over 120 countries, so has a fantastic perspective that way. He's the author of over 10 books, which includes Lonely Planet, Rough Guides. He has a weekly syndicated travel column in over 40 newspapers for 5 years. He's hosted a travel channel show, served as a correspondent for Public Radio Savvy Traveler Show, served as a travel educator for Scandinavian Airlines In Flight Magazine. Wow. And for 3 years, he's contributed to publications such as National Geographic, Traveler, Reader's Digest, Esquire, Men's Journal, The Guardian, National Geographic Adventure, Huffington Post, and Skift.
I think I got the idea.
Yeah. So obviously, he's a well-known speaker. I actually came across Doug because I was recommended. I was looking for who is a thought leader in the industry, and I had conversations with a number of DMOs and event organizers, and Doug's name kept coming up. So I thought, you know what, we got to bring this guy on the show and get his perspective. So Doug, thanks for joining us here.
Wow. I don't even think the Dalai Lama gets that kind of a build up. Thank you. I'll try not to disappoint.
It's all in the facts, man. I mean, yeah, you've got a pretty impressive history there. Didn't even mention the fact that, you know, you've done TEDx talks and spoken at hundreds of conferences. You're definitely an in-demand keynote speaker. So really happy to have you on.
Thank you. Well, it's great to be here. I mean, I think it's cool that you're doing this, and you really caught my attention with the tourism, the management academy thing that in the tagline. I really like that because it's important. And I guess coming back to this video that was sort of started our discussion, and from a stakeholder point of view, one of the most common mistakes is that if you're a stakeholder, if you're running a resort, if you're running a tour, think of yourselves for a second, like if you're a concessionaire inside of Disney World, like you're the guy selling popcorn, you're the one running the ride or having a little restaurant there. If the theme park you happen to have that concession in totally sucks, that brings you down. You can't sell as much. You can't charge as much for your popcorn. You know, if you're in whatever Universal and Harry Potter World, you can charge $10 for your popcorn because you're there. And it's, the surroundings allow you to up your price. And so, so often, and I'm not going to take away the fact that it's a huge challenge and one that I do not know very well, like the day-to-day running of a tour operation or of a hotel. I mean, all that goes into that, the cash flow, the marketing, all the online booking and the staffing and all, I mean, all of that. I mean, that's just a huge undertaking unto itself and will keep any normal human, a team of normal humans busy year round. However, if you don't think beyond the front door or beyond the border of your property, you're shooting yourself in the foot, because the DMO typically isn't doing it for you. There's no one looking out for the quality of the attraction, of the city, of the destination. I mean, of course they care. The city cares that the streets are clean, but everyone's kind of doing their own thing. It's sort of like, imagine a theme park where every concessionaire owned it and there was no governing management and everyone was just kind of doing what they wanted to do. That's a destination. Yeah. It's like herding cats. And it's, there is no management company that's like running things and telling him like, here's our, here's how this all has to fit together and hold together. So if you have a, you know, a property that's got gorgeous kind of Caribbean water out the front door, you can charge a fortune. If you're in Topeka, Kansas, your hotel rates are going to be down a bit. I mean, so the question is, how do you look beyond your property as well and lift? So you got to lift what's in your property or what's in, you know, your, the quality of your tour. And that's, you know, service, training, and there's some stuff I can jump into with that. But then there's also outside. And that's the part that people usually fail on, because it's so hard to come together and agree on something without a managing body, you know, just taking those decisions. It's like, what do they have these property organizations that, you know, in the US and these little gated communities that say everyone has to cut their grass so-and-so. Yeah, it's ridiculous, but you kind of need some of that. That sort of stuff. So keep things together and functioning in a good way without it getting phony.
So if that's the case, I'd like to explore that idea a little bit, because I kind of like where you're going there. Are you proposing potentially, maybe not so much as like a bylaw would apply in a community, but maybe more of a standard that says, hey, in order to fit the standard of this region, this is the checklist of things that need to occur in order to...
Exactly. I think what has to happen is sort of define what success is. So I think within your organization, you know, you have your model of what success is. But from a destination standpoint, you got to sort of redefine what success means. Is success bringing in more tourists next year? Or is it bringing in more tourists while you also protect the environment and also make life quality good for the locals and also, you know, protect your heritage, culture, buildings, and this... You know, it can't just be the number of people. And for too long, we've been just looking at that number. How many, you know, how many overnights or how many arrivals? And that's the wrong metric. It's a metric that can't stand on its own. It's part of the equation, but there's more to it. You know, if you're, you know, we used to have like this, the environmental disasters where like lakes and rivers caught on fire, right? It was cheaper. They could just dump all their toxic waste in these lakes until they created laws and said, yeah, it's cheaper and you can make more money doing that, but we value the quality of the lake and the environment. Therefore, you have to spend more money and protect it. And in the long run, you'll thank us.
Yeah.
Some of that kind of stuff.
Well, I'd like to think through. Okay. No, sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking, you know, on that point, I'm going to speak from the perspective of a resort owner. That's something that has always kind of frustrated us to some degree, because I do think they're getting better, but what we've seen from our DMOs is they are constantly, they're pushing the mega highlights. So like, for instance, I'm in Calgary. So the highlight here is going to be Banff Lake Louise in the Rockies, which I'm sure you're familiar with. But that is consistently what gets pushed in the marketing and the advertising. And as you are well aware, those places are completely overrun. And I think they're doing a disservice, because I do believe that there's a lot of opportunity to go to areas beyond that and really highlight specific stories from some of these other locations so that they can spread the load. And I think you might agree with this, not only spread the load, but there's a lot of travelers out there that are willing to pay more for that more authentic or boutique experience. We're not surrounded by hordes and hordes of people taking pictures of a lake or a mountain.
Right. So, okay. So this is the destination driver thing. And I agree, if you're getting someone to come from Germany or from Brazil or from Japan, they want to see the mega highlight. Mm-hmm. And so what you want to do is manage it better. So if you take like the Harry Potter London studio tour, I think, I don't have the numbers in front of me, I think they bring like, let's say 3,000 people, they pump them through in a day. And if they just let people show up whenever they wanted to, they'd all come at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning and there'd be a long line.
Yeah.
Instead, when you book your ticket, you book a specific like half hour slot or something, or hour slot that you have to show up in, and they let in 60 people per half hour or something. Yeah. I don't know what it is exactly, but something like that, or 300 people per half hour. And they pump them through that way. And they can get through way more people and no one has to wait. So it's genius. So if you take something like Lake Louise, or there's some viewing points that everyone has to go stand at, and you sell it that way, and you say, if you pay for a hotel room that costs over $300 a night, you know, it's included. Otherwise, you pay $5, $3 or one, you know, something, and you book a slot. Mm-hmm. Or you could just make the whole thing free, or you could make the whole thing $20. I mean, however you want to do it. And you could have a, you know, a sliding dynamic scale. If you want to go at 9 a.m. or at sunrise when everyone wants to go, it's 3 times more expensive, just like they do with other things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you can sort of like suddenly you can bring through probably 3 or 4 or 5 times as many people in a really nice high quality way. So then, and here's the thing, they're not going to stand there and like muse at this lake their whole trip.
No, so, of course
not. So what happens is a lot of resorts and places like put us front and center, put us on the web page. This is where people like to spend their time. Yeah, but it's not why they book their trip. Mm-hmm. They book their trip and actually they don't even think it through, but it's to stand there for 20 minutes and gaze out at the lake and get their picture taken. But that's not how they spend their money. They spend their money on the food, going bowling, on mini golf at your resort, you know, all these kind of activities and tours. So you got to understand, like, and maybe everyone does already, but they're two very just different things. It's what they spend their money on, and there's the big draw that makes them book their ticket.
Yeah.
And it's almost never the same thing.
Well, I think, I'm sure, I mean, you are arguably, but maybe one of the world's most experienced travelers out there. I mean, you've been to all these countries, you've had all these experiences, and I'd be curious to get your perspective on this, but, I definitely don't have the same traveling acumen that you do. I've been to maybe 30 countries. But I know for myself that, yes, I do. Like, yes, I want to see the highlight. I want to see the Great Wall of China, or I want to see the temples or whatever. But the experiences that I value the most and I seek out, and I found this over time, are those that are more authentic. How do I find that small village or that small resort with the owners of that place and get a taste for what that country really represents? And I don't think that I'm alone in that perspective. I've heard that from a number of other travelers as well.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, but the thing is, let's say that you're taking your wife to Paris and she's never been, but you've been. Mm-hmm. And they say, if you come in the summer, you can go to Paris, but you won't be able to even see the Eiffel Tower. You won't go to Sacré-Cœur. You can't go to the Louvre and you can't go to Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. And you're like, and you really, that wasn't why you wanted to take her. You wanted to do some nice strolls and go to some nice restaurants and stay at a really cute little boutique hotel that you found. But you're like, I still really wanted to show her that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's what I'm saying, is if you can give that kind of little sliver to the people that it's an important piece of their trip, they also understand it's not going to be, when you ask them what their favorite thing was, it's definitely not going to be on that list.
Yeah.
It's going to, but it's when they book their ticket, they kind of feel they got to, there's like a tractor beam that's sucking us towards those things. And if we feel like if we for some reason don't go, it's like we've cursed our family name for generations. Mm. You know, people be like, you didn't go to the Great Wall when you were in China? What's wrong with you? And you're like, was it closed? You're like, no, I just didn't feel like going. They're like, that's weird. You know, I mean, there's this weird cultural thing where you feel you're supposed to go do this stuff. It's just like pulling you in. And so how do we balance that? Let them have that little slice. Let that be the attraction thing. But then, you know, you offer, here's where you're going to spend your time. You'll be hiking. You'll be staying in this nice hotel. You'll be doing this and that. How can you make, and you put limits on these things, and you balance them out so you get maximum people through in a really high quality way, protect the environment, protect the experience. And then when they say, we'd like to stay at the Fairmont Banff Fairmont, and they say, sorry, it's fully booked. And they go, okay, what else? And they talk to their operator. They talk, you know, they look online and they go, oh, here's 9 other properties that are at that level that are within, you know, an hour's drive. And that's, and by showing what they're full and offering, and booking.com provides some of those kind of experiences in the sense that they show what else is at that level, hotels.com. That's where those have a bit more value. Otherwise, they make it easy for people to find that kind of stuff. But I know they take a ton of your money if you're going to put on your, you know, private resort hat for a second. I know they're a drain and they offer like, you know, next to nothing and they take all your money and they, I get it.
Even that part, like I'm almost okay with that. I'm like, okay, there's a value to that experience. But that's where the value often, for this is personal, this is for me, but this is where the value detracts is seeing the destination itself is fantastic. It's phenomenal. And that's the reason it became a destination. Right. However, the thing that totally throws it off for me is like the crowds that are everywhere. I'm like, I almost feel like I can't enjoy this experience because I have so many people that are like bumping me around and telling me to get on their photos and like,
exactly.
So it ruins the actual experience. Visually, the thing is amazing, but the whole experience is, and it doesn't feel authentic. I think that's the other part of it. It's not like you're there and you're like, okay, this now all of a sudden it feels like you're just a herd of cattle that are getting pushed through.
And so one of the things that happens is that, let's even say you could set up these little peak spots in a way that you could get maximum people through, you know, so that it was like, we said, okay, when there's more than 40 people here looking at the lake, it feels crappy. So let's say 40 people and everyone, how long do you like to stand there? You do some surveys. Okay. People like to stand there for 20, 30 minutes. All right. So we book them in 30 minute slots and now you're cranking people through. And then something else is going to get crowded. So you then have to manage that thing. And as you kind of start filling up and going through your bottlenecks and managing them and pushing people out, what you might find is people are going to go, well, when we've hit max at all these things, we only have this many people. And we know that a certain percentage stay in Airbnb. This leaves this much percentage for hotels. And, you know, we got too many hotels. And then that might be the case, is that you might have too many hotels. You know, if you have the hotels that supports an overcrowded destination, if you try to rein in the number of people, yeah, there's maybe going to be fewer people. I mean, you'll try to do it in a smart way so that you can maximize the amount of people you can have while it feels good. But you might find a situation where when you start doing that, they're going to say, well, we can only handle whatever, 4,000 people a day. And the hotels are going, wait a second, we have like 6,000 people a day capacity. What the hell are you doing? Well, like, we never told you to go build all these hotels. You did that without looking at the capacity of the city. So, I mean, you're bad. You should have, I mean, it's hard to say that in retrospect, but I mean, that's going to be the reality of it when you start managing it. And it's either going to be that, it's either some hotels are going to have to shut down and, but the ones that are there are going to be able to elevate their prices because they're going to have a higher quality product. And it's going to have, something has to come into equilibrium. It's out of balance. There's too many visitors and the hotel's saying, okay, we realize we have too many visitors. If you bring on the visitors, now who's going to be the hotel that's got to close? That's where it gets a little,
Well, that's a real scenario if that happens. So
that's why it doesn't happen, by the way.
Yeah.
Because the hotels go, whoa, shutting us, you know, wait, what? And then it doesn't happen.
Well, let me ask you this, and I'm definitely biased here because I am involved in a resort. We've got a pretty large acreage. It's a very different, for us, we define it as a very, very different experience than staying at a hotel.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to know from you, just talking to all the individuals that you have talked to over the last 20 years, where you see the hotel industry specifically going, because I think there's a number of encroaching, I've got the water running here. There's a number of encroaching, competitive forces that are happening within this travel industry. You've got Airbnb coming in, which is massive for hotels. And looking at, let's say some of the resort experiences, are the hotels facing a situation where they're going to have to adapt in some way, do something differently than they have in the past, because they don't have necessarily the product offering, that's going to be as attractive to the modern traveler.
I mean, I can say this. I think that Airbnbs, short-term rentals, should be regulated. And this should be done. it's up to each destination to do it as they see fit. If it can be done in a really clever way so that they can get the most out of it. So they can go, you know, people with 4 kids, 3 kids and more weren't coming because they'd have to get 2 or 3 hotel rooms and it was out of their price range. And the hotels people go, yeah, that's actually true. So they're not a real threat to us. So, okay, let's open up, places that can hold, large families and make those kind of properties available. Okay, what about little old ladies that want to rent out a bedroom for backpackers? Now, that's kind of nice. I'm just saying you can kind of regulate it in a way that helps the community, that's even in some ways less of a threat to the hotels, and then maybe even some higher end properties if you have a reduced capacity. And this is kind of one of the things that COVID's allowing people to do is that thing. Normally they'd say we have reduced capacity. They go, what? That sucks. But if you say, sorry, social distancing, reduced capacity. Oh, sorry. They suddenly get it and that they have to make sacrifices.
Yeah.
This is kind of part of the equation. And, I think hotels need to start. I mean, when I was there in Alberta before, I was talking to some of the guys who ran their own Sunshine. Is that the name of the
Yeah, community? Sunshine. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was telling me how it's changed over the years that people are taking much shorter ski trips.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is some of these kind of micro trips and bleisure trips. And so when things are shorter that way, you spend more time in transit, checking in, checking out, and less time, less long stays at the hotel. So a bigger chunk of your trip, percentage-wise, is those days when you're in transit, coming and going. And if you happen to have a plane that leaves late in the evening, or you happen to have a flight that landed, that came in 9 in the morning, because that was the cheap airfare or the only flight or the only direct connection or whatever, it's not your fault, but you're treated like a second-class citizen at hotels. It's like, oh, you have to get out of your room at 11. Well, we'll extend it to 12. You're like, yeah, but my flight's not until 9. You have to live out of my luggage in a locker, And so there needs to be some solutions. Do you have a cabana? Do you have special rooms? I mean, that's a big thing. How do you get people to feel less like second-class citizens while they're coming and going? I travel a lot, and I hate that.
That's a really, really valid point. It makes me also think, hey, what could we be doing better even at our own destination? Because you have the forces of saying, okay, well, we've got new guests coming in, so we have to get those guests out so that we can clean the rooms and refresh and all that. But you're absolutely right. We should probably do a better job of actually creating a space for that interim period. It's really valid. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's stuff like that. And I was going to say, if we're talking about tours, like the tour operator tour. I guess you have some of these in your portfolio of listeners.
Yeah, I've got a number of tour operators out there, yeah.
Like one of the things that I mean, there's two big things. One is like just keeping that service high so that all your guys get great service training. They can all handle and, people abuse flight attendants and other people in the service industry and take out all their life troubles on, the concierge front desk. And it's not fair. But people have been doing this for a while. They know how to turn, they know how to solve problems and kind of disarm those people. And so that takes training. And so it's good to have as much of that training as possible. The other thing is finding like your aha moment. And just a quick little anecdote. In Iceland, they had this like burrowed into the glacier and they built a church in the glacier. And they thought that was like the big moment when people got to see this underground or under glacier ice church. Yeah. And that's what they've been thinking for quite some time. And then finally they did an audit and tried to, survey the people and see what was their favorite thing and what was the thing that took their breath away. And it turned out that one of the guides happened to be a singer. And when they got to the church, he said, hey, check this out. The acoustics here are amazing. And he did like a little yoinking, this kind of yodeling from the north. I'm not going to try to replicate it.
Come on. I'm sure it'd be amazing.
so he did that. And then suddenly on these reviews, they're going, wow, everyone who had that guide said the highlight of their trip was the singing. Mm. Well, so what did they do? After the survey and they realized this, they only hired guides who could sing and they instructed them to do a little singing sample when they got to this part of the cave. And it elevated the tour experience and they got higher reviews.
Interesting.
So sometimes you think but you need to survey and be on top of this kind of stuff. What else was I going to say about that? Now, those are the main two things. learning from mistakes, understanding that you start a tour, you're going to get some negative reviews, and you know, address them professionally. Make sure you write them. Be very generous. Give them another free tour, or offer them a free drink. That's one of the best things that can, by the way, that can happen in the service industry and tourism, is that you can screw up. If you have not major screw ups, you know, like the ceiling crashes in and kills them while they're sleeping. I mean, like, I mean, I'm talking like if you bring them a drink and you've got the cocktail wrong, and you're like, I asked for a, you know, mojito and you brought me a caipirinha, you jerk, you know, and you're gonna go, instead of saying, come on, it's basically the same thing, instead of trying to like argue the person or just kind of go, oh, okay, fine, and walk off with an attitude, go, I'm really sorry, let me fix this for you right away. And then you go back to the bar and you overfix the hell out of that.
Yeah.
And you come back with like this monster mojito, and you you give them a thing of snacks as well. I mean, it cost you nothing. And suddenly they're like, oh my God, these people are so nice. I mean, they just made the simplest mistake and look what I'm getting. And if you had just tried to come out to some guests where you hadn't made a mistake and said, hey, let me give you some free pretzels and a free extra, they'd be like, okay, dude, what's the catch? Yeah. What are you going to do? Are you going to hit me up for my email now? Or like, what's coming now? But you've disarmed them when they screw up. It's a perfect situation to win loyalty and overfix. Yeah. And it's one of the most missed opportunities in the service business is to overfix mistakes. You almost want something to go wrong with every guest in a little way, and then overfix the crap out of it and blow them away.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Like looking at it from the perspective of someone that runs a destination, those guests become your biggest fans. They're the ones that talk about you the most, and you get tons of referrals from them. The ones where there was some kind of screw up and you said, hey, well, even sometimes there's even been instances where it's not even really our screw up, but we go above and beyond to fix it anyway. And then they become massive loyal advocates for you for, so you're absolutely right. I think anybody that's,
you almost want to look for it. You almost want to be like, did we screw up?
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, let us fix it.
Yeah.
You know, even when they didn't screw up, like to like, yeah. Cause you know, people are vulnerable when there's a screw up. They feel, and you know, that some, it was an injustice that they're paying for this and they're not getting what they asked for, and no one's listening. So if you just listen, so that's the thing. There's like a couple stages, and I don't have them, you know, top of mind right now, but it's like, listen, repeat back what you hear the problem is. Mm-hmm. So we got your order wrong, and you actually wanted to do this. I understand, relate your sympathies. I'm sorry we messed that up, and then we're gonna fix it for you, and we'll be right back. I make this our top priority. Okay, you show you care, then you overfix the hell out of it, mm-hmm. and then you say, do you feel that we were able to solve things to your satisfaction? Yes. You know, bam, those are like the stages. And if you hit those, there's not one guest that will leave like super impressed. I mean, you can spend millions on a lobby and they'll remember that extra thing of pretzels you got.
Yeah. Which is actually, that brings up another interesting point. And I forget the name of the guy now, but there's a individual that I came across, and he's developing, a new chain of resorts. And he's got a perspective on this. And he says, okay, rather than spending the money on grandiose architecture, what if we took all of that and we put it into the experience? So the architecture itself is fairly basic. I mean, it's nice, but it's still fairly basic. And he said,
right,
we're actually going to put more into training on the service side, and see if that is something that actually enhances the experience more than just the architecture. And I'm wondering if that's maybe an evolution in tourism in general, if it's saying, hey, we're going to actually spend less money on the accommodation and more money, if we have a budget, and more of that money on the training and seeing how we can create experiences that are beyond just the place that you stay.
Yeah. I mean, there might be just a generation of travelers that expect a big fancy lobby, kind of like the grandeur, and kind of, this is their escapism, and it's part of what they like about going to hotels. I don't know.
Well, let me.
It depends who you're going after. The younger people probably care a little bit less about that than the older set.
I had a conversation with a guy that runs unique safari experiences in Africa. And what he told me was, you know, we had this generation of travelers that are closer to the baby boomer age, and they're the ones that majority of the time have more money to spend on these experiences. And they definitely are the ones that like to sit and relax with a glass of wine and be in a nice environment and be pampered a bit. But what he's starting to see is a shift that's not directly correlated to age, but to the generation, is that he says, we, like, those people have wanted that experience since they were 40, 50. And now maybe they're getting into their 60s, 70s, 80s. But this generation that's coming up now, that's in their 30s, 40, well, more 40s, 50s, that's the generation that was the generation that really kind of pioneered, let's say, extreme sports or adventure and all of that stuff. And we're seeing more of that now in that generation, where they're saying, I don't want to just sit here and sip a glass of wine and watch nature, or just take the safari tour. I want there to be a lot more interaction involved with that. And they put less emphasis or less care on those just relaxing experiences in the nice environment. Not to say there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I think all of us appreciate that to some degree, but there's more of an emphasis on how do I actually get engaged, get involved, where now they want to spend more time. In his case, for instance, he takes a lot of people now out to actually interact with the bushmen and spend a few days almost roughing it, and then take them back to a luxury experience. Yeah. Because they want to be involved. They want to be in it. And I'm wondering, if you have anything to say about that, with potentially there being a generational difference in what travelers are looking for.
Yeah, it's not so new. I mean, Abercrombie and Kent did the stuff. There's like the bespoke, they've been writing for ages, including myself, you know, about the bespoke tours for the rich people who want to rough it for a little bit here and there. That's been going on for some time. It's not new, but it's just kind of new to each generation. So it feels new. It's kind of like when you said you're married.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if you look at a wedding magazine, you know, they can regurgitate the same stuff all year round, because you subscribe it to for like 3 months when you're interested in planning your wedding, and then you don't care anymore. And so this sort of the same kind of thing happens with this stuff. There is some of that. And I mean, I'm in that generation you're talking about. I was a backpacker for 10 years.
Yeah.
And then, you know, now I travel almost, I would say almost exclusively when it's my own time, and I get to a lot of cities. I get squeeze that in on when I'm working. But I mean, when it's my own time, I travel for skiing, kite surfing, or triathlon training.
Interesting.
That's it. That's it. So if there's a facilities for any of those things that they can lure me there, but I don't get lured with a fancy hotel. I want it to be like decent.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's, I don't feel like I will rough it, but I'm not like dying to go rough it. It's more like whatever, medium, $100 a night, kind of decent sort of thing. But it's not, I'm not looking fancy.
I'd like to know a little bit more about Doug Lansky. I want to know the Doug Lansky that got into this. So
you're gonna put your Oprah hat on.
I don't know. What's that?
You're gonna put your Oprah hat on.
I'm gonna put my Oprah hat on. Absolutely. Which I'm the world's worst Oprah, but I'd like to explore this a little bit. Let's go back. Tell me a little bit more about who was Doug Lansky in high school. Where did you, because you grew up in the States, right?
Yeah, Minnesota. So almost Canada.
Minnesota. Yeah.
I mean, I was not really into traveling when I was young. Went to visit some cousins who were, the dad had a sabbatical as a professor in Japan. We went to Japan when I was like 14. That was kind of my big trip. Otherwise, we went skiing or went to Florida or whatever, typical kind of Americana stuff. Went off to college. And then it was like my junior year of college, I went to London to study because I didn't think I was any good at languages and I'd never learned any. Live with a family, and they didn't want to get to know. And it was another kid living there as well. They didn't want to get to know us because they'd been hosting people and they do it just for the money and they didn't really care about us. So I started hitchhiking on the weekends over to Bath, up to Edinburgh, and then went that summer. I got a Euro pass, and that's when I got hooked. I ended up down in, where was I, in Portugal, then down into Morocco, and I met a Moroccan guy. I ended up living with these Moroccan guys for a week, and one guy, his brother owned a carpet shop, so I like brought tourists to his carpet shop, and I was making a commission on the sales. And
that's awesome.
I was making good money. I was making like $500 a day bringing people to this guy's carpet shop.
Wow.
It was crazy. I just did it for like a week or something.
Whole experience as a carpet connoisseur.
I knew nothing about it. I just kind of go, the biggest carpet shop is 100 yards that way, and I have a little kid here who will keep everyone out of the way, and we can just walk over there, and I'll bring you back, and I'll just sit there and drink tea, and just wave to, you know, wave to me when you want to come back to your hotel, and I'll bring you back. And they're like, that sounds good. And we just did that.
Wow.
And anyway, so I, you know, I did all sorts of weird stuff. When I graduated, I went back after that summer, and I didn't even want to finish college.
Sorry, what did you study in college? And is that related at all to what you're doing now?
Nothing really. I did a political. I studied for like philosophy and economics. Hmm. And I was the editor of the newspaper, and I wrote the opinion column. And I, what else I do? I was also the subscription manager and the ad manager. And I started a Lampoon publication, and I was like the student president. So I was like busy, and I did like 8 different intramural sports. So I was just kind of like running around. It was a small liberal arts school, so you could kind of run everything after the second year. So I was busybody and doing a lot of sports. And then I took off to see the world, and I kind of, you know, thought I was going to be back. I got a job at the New Yorker right out of college. I'd been interning in the summers, like for David Letterman and at the New Yorker and Spy magazine, and got a gig at the New Yorker right out of college. And I said, I was kind of thinking I'd travel for like half a year or 3 months. And they said, we don't need you. You know, you can go away for 3 months. You could start in 3 months or 6 months. I said, great. And then I just never came home. I just kind of kept going and going and going. And I sent a postcard to the person, like, thank you for the job offer, but I'm just having fun. Bye. And I just kept going. I was like, I did all sorts of weird stuff. You know, I picked mangoes on a kibbutz in Israel for a few months, and I was a DJ at a club med in Bali. Didn't know anything about any of that. I mean, I stopped in Guatemala and lived with a family there for a month or two and learned Spanish, and then traveled in South America. I ended up buying a horse in Ecuador and riding it around in Colombia. I mean, I did all sorts of crazy, weird, you know, fun adventure stuff. And then got back, and my dad's like, all right, so you got that out of your system. Are you ready to get a real job and get to work? And I was like, thinking travel writer sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
It was like,
so you, when you went
wrong answer.
Were you writing along the way or about those?
Yeah. I was keeping a journal. And then whenever I got to kind of a, they didn't have internet cafes at the time. They had like a giant, you know, like the Mac.
Yeah.
As a little, you know. So I'd kind of catch up with a friend in Europe or here or there. And I'd finally have like a laptop or kind of a computer. And I'd just sit down for like 3 days and just regurgitate like, you know, the last 6 months of travel experiences into some epic 40-page letter. Mm-hmm. And I'd photocopy it, send it off to like 20 different people. And then I'd do it again 6 months later. And it was like a Jack Kerouac stream of consciousness. I could just sit down and I would just write like nonstop for 36 hours. It was crazy. And then I would just go off and travel again. I got a job. So I came back. I tried to get a gig like with Rolling Stone and, you know, PJ O'Rourke stuff. They didn't even answer my letters, of course. And then I stuck with it for some months, and I thought, I'm going to try newspapers. There's like less competition there. And I had the kind of like a young humor, edgy backpacker thing going. And I got published in a few places, not much. I was very inspired when I checked out the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and saw, you know, Dear Mr. Jagger, we just don't think you have any potential. Give up.
Yeah, those stories absolutely keep you going because you're like, oh, well, if these guys got rejected, then.
Yeah, they had like gazillion. The Beatles had so many rejection letters, you know, and that egged me on a bit. And then didn't take long. Suddenly, I'd gotten in a couple newspapers here and there, and suddenly two national syndicates wanted me. And I was like, wow. And so there was like a bidding war to the bottom. I didn't end up with much money, but I got syndicated. And what normally you write for one newspaper and then they put you on the wire service. And then you start getting fan mail from different cities. You're like, wow, someone's using my stuff on the wire. So they pull it off the wire and they charge those people $5 and $10 a pop. When you get syndicated early without having that base job, you're just getting the nickel and dime stuff. Mm-hmm. So I had no real base salary and no one was paying my expenses. So I was like, first year, I think I made like $11,000 as a syndicated columnist. Mm-hmm. So I was borrowing money from my parents to be a syndicated columnist. And I was, you know, for NPR, the National Public Radio thing, I was doing some slots there, but that's like $50 a pop. So I was super broke. Youth hostels, not even youth hostels. I'd go to the youth hostel and say, can I sleep on your roof for $4? They're like, what do you do? I'm like, I'm a syndicated call. And I didn't take freebies. I could have totally like stayed in nice places, taken nice tours. I mean, I know people who are influencers.
Yeah.
Who get offered well over $1 million of trips a year.
Yeah.
And they take a lot of them. They live on them.
Yeah.
I've never done that. I never went on a media trip. I never went on a press trip, any of that kind of stuff. Didn't, no freebies. I think I took 2 freebies and I wrote about the fact that it was free in the first paragraph of the article because I couldn't do it another way.
That's a really, really great perspective because, like you said, the influencer model is completely different. It's saying, hey, how much can we leverage these free trips? Which obviously there's going to be a bias there.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that. I kind of went the other way. And I remember reading some stuff that people had gotten for free when I was, before I became a travel writer. And I remember thinking, if I ever make it, I'm never going to take freebies. Those guys are just like so on the take. I mean, it's one thing if you're a movie reviewer and you get a $10 movie. It's another thing if you're a travel reviewer and you get $10,000 valued experience. I mean, how can you? It's a flat out bribe.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I know as well, I'm going to divulge that we have worked with influencers before. And if they are an influencer and there's potential for them bringing in other guests, you're going to be biased as a destination as well. Cause you're going to say, oh, okay, if we're bringing them in, we've got to make sure that this service is something that they can talk about and write about. That's going to make us look good. So there is potential there to say, you know, are they getting the experience that every other guest gets?
Right. Yeah.
See, probably not. Right. So,
well, I mean, I would, if I were you in that, when you're wearing that hat, if I was a hotel, I'd be bringing them in. I'd look at it like I'd value manage it and say, is this a form of advertising?
Well, I mean, for us, it's super cheap. The game's changing a little bit now just because the platform algorithms are changing, but that's another discussion. But it is, it's saying, hey, do we have open slots in a prime-ish season? If we've got open slots, we open that up and say, hey, if you have this audience and you're over this amount and you're willing to publish these photos and these articles, we've got a spot for you. So basically we never really gave away spots that we couldn't right. get sold out otherwise, but if we had the odd position where we're like, hey, let's bring somebody in, it costs us literally.
Yeah. I would do it if I were you, like I said, but I mean, if I have to, like, I have to look myself in the mirror as well, if I was going to play that role or not. And so I don't look upon what they do. They didn't go through the journalism side of things. So they don't have a journalism background of how you're supposed to behave when you write about something in a totally neutral way and unbiased way. So they're not coming from that perspective. They're coming from the perspective of, I want to travel from free. What can I get? Oh, well, now I get a big audience. I can get more stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just never entered their brain to be ethical in that way for them. Not all of them, but for most of them came into it that way. And so I actually went and spoke at one of their big blogger conferences.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Didn't go over so well.
You ripped them apart.
It wasn't my best presentation. I thought it was pretty good, but they didn't really lap it up like I was hoping.
But sometimes I would guess that sometimes, not that I was at that presentation, but I would guess that sometimes those messages, they're not received well initially, but if there's truth behind it, then it's something that, you know, people can contemplate for a while and be like, yeah, what is a different way of doing this or a different perspective? Because that's
what I tell myself on every interaction I have with my teenagers. They're not appreciating this wisdom now, but someday they are going to so thank me.
Well, I'm guessing that's the same experience with your own parents probably, right? Like there are times when you're younger, you're like, whatever, mom, or whatever, dad.
Yeah.
And then later when you start maturing in the world, you're like, oh, damn, that was.
Then you're like, what a jerk. Yeah. What a horrible thing they did. No, I mean, yeah, totally. On both sides, you kind of see some of the stuff they did with a different light, and also you're more forgiving because you understand how imperfect the world is and how easy it is to mess up. But yeah, I mean, those are some back to tourism though. It's like,
yeah,
it gave me some perspective, all the travels and doing all that stuff. And And so when I kind of transitioned into writing about the travel industry, I kind of took that, this viewpoint that I had. And I think I hopefully, you know, was able to kind of cast a new look in the travel industry, because people who are in this side, everyone kind of is doing this. Everyone's like their little area of expertise. Exactly, yeah. And when you come in, like, I've got enough time to kind of look at the big picture and how does it fit together and where is it not working? And I mean, one of the things from a management point of view, we want to kind of get high tech. We'll make a little high tech prediction.
Yeah.
One thing that I was kind of pitching as a solution, and I still think is a great solution, and maybe it'll happen in our lifetimes, and it has in some small degree, that your door key, which can also work on your phone, which could also be a bracelet, which is actually my favorite solution, like a little kind of Lance Armstrong style little mini bracelet that's got an, you know, RFC, NFC.
Have you seen Disney's bracelets?
Yeah, I've seen their older ones that I had used. Yeah,
yeah, so something similar-ish to that.
Smaller, lighter, thinner, just got one, or maybe even multiple chips in it.
Yeah.
And so there's your hotel key. And your hotel key can also be your transport pass for the buses and trains in any city. They can also open lockers in the train station. And if you have nice bathrooms that are high level around the city, they could open that. They can also get you in the museum. So you're connected to your phone. So there's a little barcode on that thing as well, like a micro barcode that you take your phone and use, do it. So now it's connected. So now you take your phone and you've maybe paid for your museum times, but you still have to, you've paid for a museum pass, but you have to still select a time. So you pick your time and now it's in the system. So you just walk in with your bracelet and zip and go. So it's like, in that way, because, you know, if you have kids, you're not there yet. But usually when you have kids and you're even just trying to get on a plane, you know, the dad or the mom has all the tickets on their phone. So they're like, blip, okay, you go. Blip, okay, now you go. And when it's a bracelet, like at Disney or other places, the kids are all just like, boop, we all just walk in and tap. And it's so much more efficient. And no one loses their key and stuff. It's just right there.
That seems like a brilliant solution. And I would see it as being inevitable given a long enough timeline. Who do you foresee is the organization that actually orchestrates the implementation of that?
Well, there was funny, after I kind of made this presentation, there was this guy came up to me afterward in the Black Forest in Germany. He said, we're starting to do that. And and they brought me down there and we met with them. And sure enough, my room key could be used to enter certain attractions.
That's
The same room key. I think I have it here somewhere. Maybe not. Anyway, I had it laying around here a second ago. It looks like a normal room key. I mean, it looks like just a normal chip. It's kind of got the logo of the city on it. And the other cool thing is, and it's also connected to your phone, and they have some BMW, what is it, i3, their little electric car. That's got it's tastefully done, but it's kind of got the tourism department logo on it. And they have a bunch of them in your city share cars. So you can reserve it and use it. And it's like either included or not much extra. So you can rent your car through your phone and pick them up and drop them off wherever in the area.
It sounds so convenient. Like it's almost like taking the old school approach of the Eurorail pass, but just bringing that to everything else. Just that the tour pass or whatever you want to call it, whatever your innovative name is.
Yeah, and this would give tourism. Yeah, this would give tourism management another new role. So the trick is like integrating with people's systems. If you have a museum, or if you're, you know, I'll say it's more with museums and attractions. It's easy with tour guides. It's like a little app they have on their phone. And when people come, they have a barcode or whatever, and they all just, or NFC, and they just tap their phones together. And now they've all shown that they've purchased for that tour group. But for like a museum that's either paying, you know, for their operating system with ticketing and all that, maybe they signed a 5-year contract, or maybe they paid for one for $150,000. You know, it's hard to get them. It's like asking them to do open heart surgery. They don't want to do it. They want you to integrate.
Hey, Doug, sorry about that. For some reason, my internet just decided to cut out completely on me there.
No worries.
Sorry. Let's
talk to myself with the teenagers.
You're the only guy that listens.
Like, are you guys listening to me? Anyway, where were we at? Oh, yeah, we're talking about this, like, high-tech system. Yeah, so it's like people, it's like open heart surgery. They don't want to integrate. They're just like, you can make it work with us. We're not going to change a thing. So you want it, what you want it to be like is like with an Uber, where you have a hand and glove app. You know, the drivers have an app, the customers have an app, and it fits together. You want the same system for the whole city, and it'll work great.
Or it'll work better. Of anybody that's actually working on that? Is there an organization or a company or anything that's kind of?
There's a couple.
I mean, obviously, like dead in Bavaria there, but
The guy in Black Forest, and there was like a Swiss company that was doing to a lesser degree. They got in contact with me, but I think the guys in the Black Forest, but problem is like with the Black Forest was they needed some money. And so he partnered up with a hotel guy who had a chain of hotel, or, and he wanted it to be more of a hotel booking thing. And it kind of got a bit sidetracked, lost its focus a little. I haven't talked to him for a while, but, they're having some, you know, little issues that way and focusing. Yeah, yeah. And but they're going in the right direction. And I like the guys a lot. And then, you know, it's like you can also work with Ski Data, that company. There's another one that's called out of Slovakia called, Metric. They do a lot of the locker systems when you go to like a water park and you have lockers and you wear a little thing. And then there's another one called Gentner out of Austria. Those are like the main. So Gentner, I think it's called Matic or Matric, something like that, out of Slovakia, and the one out of Austria are the main ones that do like lockers at water parks.
Mm.
And so you could integrate with those guys. I mean, there's a whole bunch of systems. If you wanted to spend, let's say, you know, a city the size of Calgary could, I don't know what all the attractions are, but let's say you take the top five attractions and you say, what did your system cost? It was 50 grand. Here's 50 grand. You know, like if you just went around and bought everyone out and said, get on our system, it's better. Yeah. And whatever. Let's say it cost you $3 million or something to like just put this system in throughout the whole city, or $5 million or something. I think it's just, you'd make it back so quick. Look at Disney with their $1 billion investment on their magic bands.
Yeah.
They felt that was a huge success. Look what Vail did with their Epic Pass, with all the pictures that you're taking, and it keeps track of your vertical meters when you ski and all that stuff. They thought that was a huge success, and that cost a fortune.
Yeah. Well, it totally makes sense because, I mean, that's where there is a bit of a disconnect then when you've got the wristband, there's a little bit of a disconnect between you having to actually fork cash out of a wallet or use your debit card or whatever for every interaction, to just being like, hey, we just want to see this. We just want to get it done. And then it's that time where you're like, hey, we're here. We're going to enjoy the trip. And then you go home and then you deal with the credit card statement. Right.
Yeah.
So there's a little, bit of
I wouldn't make it so that you can pay in shops, because it makes the bracelet easier to, there's a higher desire to steal it. If people, it's like, who would steal your bracelet if the only thing you can do with it is go to some museums and use the public toilets and open a locker at the train station? But if you can start charging at stores with it, then it becomes something people want to steal. And also it just becomes a credit card. Then it's then it's Apple Pay.
Mm.
And by the way, you could go that way. You could just integrate everything so it's all tap and go with Apple Pay on your watch and your phone. That's another way to do the same thing. However, if you have it with your hotel key and it's like all one system, you could maybe, what you can then do is offer package things. So, okay, it's a business conference. You say, you get the toilets, we'll throw in two attractions. You get three rides on mass transit. And this is the deal we're making for your conference. You know, like you put together a package deal, and then someone can say, oh, we want the platinum package. Okay. That includes, you get free, you know, car sharing, you get this, you get that. You have some snack machines around the city that you can actually access up to 3 or 4 free snacks a day for these people. Mm. I mean, you could go all out, and you could also have, like they do at the ski resorts, where you have these photographers on the mountain and go, they just tap your thing, or they zap you with the NFC gun, and they have professionals that take your picture and it appears on your phone in 3 seconds later.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool.
Why does that only happen at a ski resort? You could do that around the city. And it happens at Disney and it happens at ski resorts.
Mm.
Why not when people are visiting a city? You do it in a clever way and it doesn't have to feel cheesy. I think people talk about Disney and it's like this negative thing, like it's become fake. They're looking at the wrong thing. They should be looking at Disney as a great example of management.
Mm. As with many private institutions, those are usually the ones that are going to lead the charge, so to speak, on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Doug, two things. One, your mic keeps rubbing on your zipper, so I can't see an interference that. So maybe just if
you can mute
that a little bit, that'd be awesome. Thanks. Let's explore.
Good that you waited an hour to tell me that.
Well, it wasn't as bad before, and then all of a sudden it just, I don't know, maybe it was your head around, whatever you're doing. Let's explore experience development a little bit. I know we've talked quite a bit on the grander scale with like what could cities do. I think your ideas with using some kind of tech RFID chip or whatever we want to call it totally makes sense. I think you can apply that on the micro level, like some of the businesses we were talking about, but definitely on the city or maybe even on a country level. That would be,
or in your area, it's like the ski resorts can just extend into the town.
Yeah. They should make sense, obviously, because that's what everyone is doing. Like the circuits are very similar. I'm sure you know that.
You just use the ski resorts thing as a base and then extend in. They grow out their service on the mountain and then you extend into the town. But I just want to say, if anyone's listening, just bring me in for some consulting on that so you don't just take my idea and run with it. I have other ideas of how you get there, and there's a whole roadmap of how you get from A to B.
Yeah.
So,
we'll make sure that we'll connect to you. At the end of this interview, we're definitely going to have, here's how to connect with Doug. So if you are listening.
By the way, I only have about 5 more minutes. I got to jump off.
Okay. So if I've got 5 more minutes, let's go with, I know, because this actually went longer than I anticipated. Let me ask you a question. Let's say that you are given a significant budget for a resort. Let's just pick something random. Let's say you've got a resort in the Caribbean. You've got a budget of a few million dollars. What would you do with it, with that budget, as far as crafting an experience that's going to attract travelers to that destination?
I have to kind of look at where, I mean, I hear what you're going for, but I have to look at the starting point. Like, you know, are there too many people? Is the water quality crap on some beaches? Is there stuff that needs fixing? I'd probably fix some stuff.
Yeah.
I'd sort of like, 80% of the visitors go to this beach and it's overcrowded. There's filth all over the place and the water quality is not great. And, you know, we're going to put some of that money into the local water treatment plant so that it's not polluting the beautiful water. We're going to put, you know, double the amount of times the garbage is picked up on the beach. We're going to limit the parking. We're going to cut the parking lot down to like half size and say no bus drop-offs. And you have to book a time slot to be there. I mean, I would address the problems. And there are problems everywhere like this. So I would probably go after that. I'd solve problems. And I'd also like do some nice landscaping in some of these areas where they're hanging out. They did this in, Guam. In Guam, they took almost half their entire marketing budget of like, you know, $8 or $10 million.
Yeah.
And they cleaned beaches and landscaped and put up nice bus shelters with it.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to me. That was actually, it ties into a podcast I did a little while ago, but it's saying, hey, take part of your marketing budget, enhance the experience, and then leverage free social media to actually tell that story.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would have like a budget for fixing stuff. I'd have a budget for like this kind of high tech integration system thing we talked about. And then I would do some kind of have a fun budget for something spectacular. Like, so in Calgary, I mentioned to some people when I was there at the conference and Banff that, you know, if I could, like, I was just spitballing. We were having a couple of drinks after dinner. And I said, if I had a couple of million dollars, and I wanted to do something fun in Calgary, I would find a part of the city as much as possible. And I'd lay down that plastic, kind of special plastic that you can ice skate on. And I would have the biggest ice skatable city year round.
That'd be pretty cool.
People could come to Calgary and ice skate everywhere.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
And you have like a special really cool kind of like a mini Zamboni that's just kind of keeping it clean, you know, and you can just ice skate all over the city and like maybe even out into nature a little bit. You can go out and have some cool ice skating trails. And then I would have the world's biggest hockey stick sculpture. I would have people send hockey sticks from all over the world, and every club ask for someone so they're part of it, so they want to come and visit it someday, and then build it into some, you know, like a kind of a cool, you know, like a player, but make it huge and make it a awesome whole thing out of hockey sticks. So it's like also it gives everyone a reason to go if their hockey stick is in the sculpture.
Yeah, they very very much involve the traveler, which is awesome.
Those two things I would do to crush it in terms of creating a more of a draw for the city.
Definitely what I'm hearing from you is there's a lot of power in saying we have to come up with something new, because it sounds to me like you really, you understand that that is the draw. There's so many cities that just replicate what other cities are doing. And I think that's a,
yeah,
that's an unfortunate thing.
Make it personal, unique to you, new and new stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. Like those two ideas, that'll get you like a couple of years. Yeah. And then you need some other amazing new stuff.
Yeah. Right. Maybe on, Doug. Well, I
hockey stick sculpture garden.
If it ever happens, we're going to credit this back to you. We can take this. It was Doug's idea first.
There we go. Awesome. Great to connect with you. Thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah. Thank you so much. There's so many other questions I'd love to explore, but I definitely appreciate your time. So let me ask this as a last question. People want to connect with you. They want to follow you. Where are the best channels to do that?
Right. So my YouTube channel, Rethinking Tourism. I'm a new YouTuber.
Yeah.
Only four videos so far.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks. I'm getting the hang of the editing just now and got a new screen in the back. So it's getting a look, the production quality is going up. So yeah, that and LinkedIn, those are the best ways.
Okay. Awesome. That's fantastic, Doug. So if you want to find Doug, you can, obviously you can find him based if you're listening to this, we'll actually put those connections into the description so you can find them there. And then, otherwise I'm sure you can just look up Doug Lansky.
Yeah, you'll find me.
A variety of platforms. Awesome. Thank you so much, Doug. Really appreciate your time. Yeah, it was awesome having you on.
Take care. Have a great day, Eric. Cheers.
Yeah.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that interview. I wanted to let you know that if you're listening to this podcast and you've got some ideas that you want to share with the industry, especially if you think they're innovative or just you've gotten amazing results with them, I'd love to have you as a guest on the show as well. If you want to write in, write to info@tourismmanagementacademy.com and we'll have a chat, we'll slot you in, and we'll see if we can bring you onto the show. All right. Have a great day. We'll talk to you in the next episode.